phrases in like 5 minutes. It had taken up to the week before Halloween to get through the BS 67, Levesque Party en Bloc Québécois, and early Front de la Libération Nationale stuff, and up to the present interdependent era.
109.
Poutrincourt's lecture voice has gotten quieter and quieter as history's approached its contemporary limit. And Hal, finding the stuff rather more high concept and less dull than he'd expected, seeing himself as, at his innermost core, apolitical, nevertheless found the Québécois separatism mentality almost impossibly convolved and confused and impervious to U.S. parsing.
110.
Plus was both con and repelled by the fact that the contemporary anti-ONAN insurgent stuff provoked in him a queasy feeling, not the glittery disorientation of nightmares or on-court panic, but a soggier, more furtively nauseous kind of sense, as if someone had been reading mail of Hal's that he'd thought he'd thrown away. The proud and haughty Québécois had been harassing and even terrorizing the rest of Canada over the separation issue for time out of mind. It was the establishment of ONAN and the gerrymandering of the Great Convexity, Poutrincourt's Canadian, recall, that turned the malevolent attention of Québécois' worst post-FLN insurgents south of the border. Ontario and New Brunswick took the continental Anschluss and territorial reconfiguration like good sports. Certain far-right fringes in Alberta weren't too pleased, but not much pleases an Albertan far-rightist anyway. It was finally only the proud and haughty Québécois who whinged, and the insurgent cells of Quebec who completely lost their political shit.
111.
Quebec's anti-ONAN and thus U.S. separatist tours, the different terrorist cells formed when Ottawa had been the foe, proved to be not a very nice bunch at all. The earliest unignorable strikes involved a then unknown terrorist cell.
112.
That apparently snuck down from the EWD blighted Papineau region at night and dragged huge standing mirrors across U.S. Interstate 87 and selected dangerous narrow winding Adirondack passes south of the border and its Lucite walls. Naively empiricist northbound U.S. motorists, a good many of them military and ONANite personnel this close to the concavity, would see impending headlights and believe, like some suicidal idiot or Canadian, had traversed the median and was coming right for them. They'd flash their high beams, but to all appearances the impending idiot would just flash his high beams right back. The U.S. motorists, usually not to be fucked with in their vehicles, historically, it was well known, would brazen it out as long as anyone right-minded possibly could. But right before apparent impact with the impending lights, they'd always veer wildly and leave shoulderless I-87 and put their arm over their head in that screaming pre-crash way and go ass over tea kettle into an Adirondack chasm with a many-petaled bloom of high-test flame. And the then-unknown Québécois terrorist cell would remove the huge mirror and truck off back up north via checkpointless backroads back into the blighted bowels of southern Quebec until next time. There were fatalities this way well into the year of the Tuck's medicated pad before anyone had any idea they were diabolic cell-related. For over 20 months, the scores of burnt-out hulls piling up in Adirondack chasms were regarded as either suicides or inexplicable, doze-behind-the-wheel-type single-car accidents by new New York State troopers who had to detach their chin straps to scratch under their big brown hats over the mysterious sleepiness that seemed to afflict Adirondack motorists at what looked to be high-adrenaline mountaintop passes. Chief of the new United States Office of Unspecified Services, Rodney Tyne, pressed, to his later embarrassment, for a series of anti-driving when drowsy public service spots to be interlaced disseminated in upstate New York. It was an actual U.S. would-be suicide, a late-stage Valium-addicted Amway distributor from Schenectady, who was at the end of her benzodioxane rope, and all over the road anyway, and who by historical accounts saw the sudden impending headlights in her northbound lane as grace, and shut her eyes and floored it right for them, the lights, never once veering, spraying glass and micronized silver all over four lanes. This unwitting civilian who smashed the illusion, made the breakthrough, these were media headlines, and brought to light the first tangible evidence of an anti-ONAN ill will, way worse than anything aroused by plain old historical separatism up in Quebec. The first birth of the Incandenza's second son was a surprise. The tall and eye-poppingly curvaceous Avril Incandenza did not show, bled like clockwork, no hemorrhoids or gland static, no pica, affect and appetite normal. She threw up some mornings, but who didn't in those days? It was on a metal-lit November evening in the seventh month of a hidden pregnancy that she stopped, Avril, on her husband's long arm as they ascended the maple staircase of the Back Bay brownstone they were soon to leave, stopped, turned partly toward him, ashen, and opened her mouth in a mute way that was itself eloquent. Her husband looked down at her, paling. "What is it?"
"It's pain."
It was pain. Broken water had made several steps below them gleam. She seemed to James Incandenza to sort of turn in toward herself, hold herself low, curl, and sink to a stair step she barely made the edge of, hunched, her forehead against her shapely knees. Incandenza saw the whole slow thing in a light like he was Vermeer. She sank steadily from his side, and he bent to hers, and she then tried to rise. "Wait, wait, 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 wait.
It's pain."
A bit ragged from an afternoon of wild turkey and low-temperature holography, James had thought Avril was dying right before his eyes. His own father had dropped dead on a set of stairs. Luckily, Avril's half-brother Charles Tavis was upstairs, using the portable Stairmaster he'd brought with him for an extended and emotional battery-recharging visit the preceding spring, after the horrible snafu with the video scoreboard at Toronto Sky Dome. And he heard the commotion and scuttled out and down and promptly took charge. He had to be more or less scraped out, Mario, like the meat of an oyster, from a womb whose sides he'd been found spiderishly clinging, tiny and unobtrusive, attached by cords of sinew at both feet and a hand, the other fist stuck to his face by the same material.
113.
He was a complete surprise, and terribly premature, and withered, and he spent the next many weeks waggling his withered and contractured arms up at the Pyrex ceilings of his incubators, being fed by tubes and monitored by wires and cupped in sterile palms, his head cradled by a thumb. Mario had been given the name of Dr. James Incandenza's father's father, a dour and golf-addicted Green Valley, Arizona oculist who made a small fortune just after Jim grew up and fled east by inventing those, quote, X-ray specs that don't work, but whose allure for mid-60s pubescent comic book readers almost compelled mail order, then selling the copyrights to New England novelty industry titan Acme Co., then promptly, in mid-putt, died. Mario Sr. did, allowing James Incandenza Sr. to retire from a sad third career as the man from GLAD in sandwich bag commercials during the BS 1960s, and move back to the saguaro-studded desert he loathed, and efficiently drank himself to a cerebral hemorrhage on a Tucson stairway.
114.
Anyway, Mario II's incomplete gestation and arachnoidal birth left the kid with some lifelong character-building, physical challenges. Size was one, he being in sixth grade about the size of a toddler, and at 18-plus in a range somewhere between elf and jockey. There was the matter of the withered-looking and brady-auxetic arms, which, just as in a hair-raising case of Volkmann's contracture, curled out in front of his thorax in majuscule S's and were usable for rudimentary, knifeless eating and slapping at doorknobs until they sort of turned just enough and doors could be kicked open and forming a pretend lens frame to scout scenes through, plus maybe tossing tennis balls very short distances to players who wanted them, but not for much else, though the arms were impressively, almost familial dysautonomically, pain-resistant, and could be pinched, punctured, singed, and even compressed in a basement optical device-securing vice-like thing by Mario's older brother Orin, without effect or complaint.
115.
Brady pedestrianism-wise, Mario had not so much club feet as more like block feet, not only flat but perfectly square, good for kicking knob-fumbled doors open with, but too short to be conventionally employed as feet. Together with the lordosis in his lower spine, they forced Mario to move in the sort of lurchy half-stumble of a vaudeville inebriate, body tilted way forward as if into a wind, right on the edge of pitching face first onto the ground, which as a child he did fairly often, whether given a bit of a shove from behind by his older brother Orin or no. The frequent forward falls help explain why Mario's nose was squished severely in and so flared out to either side of his face but did not rise from it, with the consequence that his nostrils tended to flap just a bit, particularly during sleep. One eyelid hung lower than the other over his open eyes, good and gently brown eyes, if a bit large and protrusive, to qualify as conventionally human eyes. The one lid hung like an ill-tempered window shade, and his older brother, Orin, had sometimes tried to give the recalcitrant lid that smart type of downward snap that can unstick a dicky shade, but had succeeded only in gradually loosening the lid from its sutures, so that it eventually had to be refashioned and reattached in yet another blepharoplasty procedure. Because it was in fact not Mario's real eyelid. That had been sacrificed when the fist stuck to his face like a tongue to cold metal had been peeled away at nativity. But an extremely advanced blepharoprosthesis of dermal fibropolymer studded with horsehair lashes that curved out into space well beyond the reach of his other lid's lashes, and together with the lazy lid action itself gave even Mario's most neutral expression the character of an oddly friendly pirate's squint, together with the involuntary constant smile. This is probably also the place to mention Hal's older brother Mario's khaki-colored skin, an odd dead gray-green that in its corticate texture, and together with his atrophic, incurled arms and arachnodactylism gave him, particularly from a middle distance, an almost uncannily reptilian dinosaurian look, the fingers being not only mucronate and talonesque, but non-prehensile, which is what made Mario's knife work untenable at table. Plus, the thin, lank, slack hair, at once tattered and somehow too smooth, that looked at 18 plus like the hair of a short, plump, 48-year-old stress engineer and athletic director and academy headmaster, who grows one side to girlish length and carefully combs it so it rides thinly up and over the gleaming yarmulke of bare, gray-green, complected scalp on top and down over the other side where it hangs, lank, and fools no one, and tends to flap back up over in any wind Charles Tavis forgets to carefully keep his left side to. Or that he's slow, Hal's brother is, technically, Stanford Binet-wise slow, the Brandeis CDC found, but not, verifiably not, retarded or cognitively damaged or bradyphrenic. More like refracted, almost. Ever so slightly epistemologically bent. A pole poked into mental water and just a little off and just taking a little bit longer in the manner of all refracted things. Or that his status at the Enfield Tennis Academy, erected along with Dr. and Mrs. I's marriage's third and final home at the northern rear of the grounds when Mario was 9 and Hallie 8 and Orin 17 and in his one ETA year B4 singles and in the USTA's top 75, that Mario's life there is by all appearances kind of a sad and left-out type existence. The only physically challenged minor in residence, unable even to grip a regulation stick or stand unaided behind a boundaried space. That he and his late father had been, no pun intended, inseparable. That Mario'd been like an honorary assistant production assistant, and carried the late Incandenza's film and lenses and filters in a complex backpack the size of a joint of beef for most of the last 3 years of the late blooming filmmaker's life, attending him on shoots and sleeping with multiple pillows in small, soft, available spaces in the same motel rooms as himself, and occasionally tottering out for a bright red plastic bottle of something called Big Red Soda Water, and taking it to the apparently mute, veiled graduate intern down the motel's hall, fetching coffee and Joe and various pancreatitis remedies and odds and ends for props, and helping D-Leith out with continuity when Incandenza wanted to preserve continuity, basically being the way any son would be whose dad let him into his heart's final and best-loved love, lurching gamely, but not pathetically, to keep up with a tall, stooped, increasingly bats man's slow, patient, 2-meter stride through airports, train stations, carrying the lenses, inclined ever forward, but in no way resembling any kind of leashed pet. When required to stand upright and still, like when videotaping an ETA service motion or manning the light meters on the set of a high-contrast chiaroscuro art film, Mario in his forward list is supported by a new New York City apartment door-style police lock, a 0.7-meter steel pole that extends from a special Velcroed vest and angles about 40 degrees down and out to a slotted piece of lead blocking. A bitch to carry in that complicated pack, placed by someone understanding and prehensile on the ground before him. He stood thus buttressed on sets himself, had him help erect and furnish in light, the lighting usually unbelievably complex, and for some parts of the crew sometimes almost blinding, sunbursts of angled mirrors and merino lamps and keylight kleegs, Mario getting a thorough technical grounding in a cinematic craft he never even imagined being able to pursue on his own until Christmas of the year of the trial-sized Dove Bar, when a gaily wrapped package forwarded from the offices of Incandenza's attorney revealed that himself had designed and built and legally willed, in a codicil, to be gaily wrapped and forwarded for Mario's 13th Christmas, a trusty old Bolex H64 Rex 5 tri-lensed camera.
116.
Bolted to an oversized old leather aviator's helmet and supported by struts, whose ends were the inverted tops of training room crutches and curved nicely over Mario's shoulders. So the Bolex H64 required no digital prehensility because it fit over Mario's oversized face like a tri-plated scuba mask and was controlled by a sewing machine-adapted foot treadle.
117.
But even then, it took some serious getting used to. And Mario's earliest pieces of digital juvenilia are marred/enhanced by this palsied, pointing every which way quality of like home movies shot at a dead run. 5 years hence, Mario's facility with the head mount Bolex attenuates the sadness of his status here, allowing him to contribute via making the annual ETA fundraising documentary cartridge, videotaping students' strokes, and occasionally from over the railing of Stitt's supervisory transom, the occasional challenge match. The tapings become part of the pro-instruction package detailed in the ETA catalog, plus producing more ambitious, arty-type things that occasionally find a bit of an Aucliffe-type following in the ETA community. After Oren Incandenza left the nest to first hit and then kick collegiate balls, there was almost nobody at ETA or its Enfield Brighton environs who did not treat Mario M. Incandenza with the casual gentility of somebody who doesn't pity you or admire you so much as just vaguely prefer it when you're around. And Mario, despite rectilinear feet and cumbersome police lock, the most prestigious walker and recorder in 3 districts, hit the unsheltered area streets daily at a very slow pace, a halting constitutional, sometimes with head-mounted Bolex and sometimes not, and took citizens' kindness and cruelty the same way, with a kind of extra-inclined half-bow that mocked his own canted posture without pity or cringe. Mario's in a special favorite among the low-rent shopkeepers up and down ETA's stretch of Commonwealth Avenue. And photographic stills from some of his better efforts adorn the walls behind certain Commonwealth Avenue deli counters,
and steam presses and Korean-keyed cash registers.
The object of a strange and maybe kind of clicky affection from Lyle, the spandexed sweat guru, to whom he sometimes brings caffeine-free Diet Cokes to cut the diet's salt. Mario sometimes finds younger ETAs referred to him by Lyle on really ticklish matters of injury and incapacity and character and rallying what remains, and never much knows what to say. Trainer Barry Loach all but kisses the kid's ring, since it's Mario who, through coincidence, saved him from the rank panhandling underbelly of Boston Commons netherworld and more or less got him his job.
118.
Plus, of course, there's the fact that Shtit himself constitutionalizes with him of certain warm evenings and lets him ride in his surplus sidecar. An object of some weird, attracto-repulsive gestalt for Charles Tavis, Mario treats CT with the quiet deference he can feel his possible half-uncle wanting, and stays out of his way as much as possible for Tavis's sake. Players at Denny's, when they all get to go to Denny's, almost vie to see who gets to cut up the cuttable parts of Mario's under-12-size kilo breakfast. And his younger and way more externally impressive brother Hal almost idealizes Mario, secretly. God-type issues aside, Mario is a semi-walking miracle, Hal believes. People who are somehow burned at birth, withered or ablated way past anything like what might be fair, they either curl up in their fire, or else they rise. Withered Saurian homodonic Mario floats for Hal.
119.
He calls him boo-boo, but fears his opinion more than probably anybody, except their moms's. Hal remembers the unending hours of blocks and balls on the hardwood floors of early childhood's 36 Bell Avenue, west in Massachusetts. Tangrams and See and Spell, huge-headed Mario hanging in there for games he could not play, for make-believe, and which he had no interest other than proximity to his brother. Avril remembers Mario still wanting Hal to help him with bathing and dressing at 13, an age when most unchallenged kids are ashamed of the very space their sound pink bodies take up, and wanting the help for Hal's sake, not his own. Despite himself, and showing a striking lack of insight into his mom's psyche, Hal fears that Avril sees Mario as the family's real prodigy, an inbent, savant-type genius of no classifiable type, a very rare and shining thing, even if his intuition, slow and silent, scares her. His academic poverty breaks her heart. The smile he puts on each AM without fail since the suicide of their father makes her wish she could cry. This is why she tries so terribly hard to leave Mario alone, not to hover or ring, to treat him so less specially than she wants. It is for him. It is kind of noble, pitiable. Her love for the son who was born a surprise transcends all other experiences and informs her life. Hal suspects. It was Mario, not Avril, who obtained Hal his first copies of the unabridged OED at a time when Hal was still being shunted around for the assessment of possible damage, boo-boo pulling them home in a wagon by his bicuspids over the fake rural blacktop roads of upscale Weston, months before Hal tested out at whatever's beyond eidetic on the mnemonic verbal inventory designed by a dear and trusted colleague of the mom's at Brandeis. It was Avril, not Hal, who insisted that Mario live not in the headmaster's house with her and Charles Tavis, but with Hal in an ETA subdorm. But in the year of dairy products from the American heartland, it was Hal, not she, who, when the veiled legate from the union of the hideously and improbably deformed showed up at the ETA driveway's portcullis to discuss with Mario issues of blind inclusion versus visual estrangement, of the openness of concealment the veil might afford him, it was Hal, even as Mario laughed and half-bowed, it was Hal, brandishing his Dunlop stick, who told the guy to go peddle his linen someplace else. The 30th of April to the 1st of May, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. The sky of USA's desert was clotted with blue stars. Now it was deep at night. Only above the USA city was the sky blank of stars. Its color was pearly and blank. Marat shrugged.
Perhaps in you is the sense that citizens of Canada are not involved in the real root of the threat?
Steeply shook the head in seeming annoyance.
What's that supposed to mean? He said.
The lurid wig of him slipped when he moved the head with any abrupt force. The first way Marat betrayed anything of emotion was to smooth rather too fussily at the blanket on his lap.
It is meaning that it will not a finality be Quebecers making this kick to
l'un des États-Unis.
Look, the facts of the situation speak loudly. What is known? This is a USA production, this entertainment cartridge, made by an American man in the USA. The appetite for the appeal of it, this also is USA. The USA drive for spectation, which your culture teaches. This, I was saying, this is why choosing is everything. When I say to you choose with great care in loving, and you make ridicule, it is why I look and say, can I believe this man is saying this thing of ridicule?
Marat leaned slightly forward on his stumps, leaving the machine pistol to use both his hands and saying. Steeply could tell this was important to Marat. He really believed it. Marat made small, emphatic circles and cuts in the air while he spoke.
This facts of situation, which speaks so loudly of your bureau's fear of this samizdat, now is what has happened when a people choose nothing over themselves to love, each one. A USA that would die, and let its children die, each one, for this so-called perfect entertainment, this film. Who would die for this chance to be fed this death of pleasure with spoons? In their warm homes, alone, unmoving? You, Steeply, in complete seriousness, as a citizen of your neighbor, I say to you, forget for a moment the entertainment, and think instead about a USA where such a thing could be possible enough for your office to fear. Can such a USA hope to survive for a much longer time? To survive as a nation of peoples? To much less exercise dominion over other nations of other peoples? If these are other peoples who still know what it is to choose, who will die for something larger, who will sacrifice their warm home, the loved women at home, their legs, their life even, for something more than their own wishes of sentiment? Who will choose not to die for pleasure alone?
Steeply removed with cool deliberation another Belgian cigarette and lit it, this time on the first match, waving the match out with a circular flourish and snap. All this took time of his silence. Marat settled back. Marat wondered why the presence of Americans could always make him feel vaguely ashamed after saying things he believed, an aftertaste of shame after revealing passion of any belief and type when with Americans, as if he had made flatulence instead of had revealed belief. Steeply rested his one elbow on the forearm of the other arm across his prostheses, to smoke like a woman.
You're saying that the administration wouldn't even be concerned about the entertainment if we didn't know we were fatally weak, as in, as a nation. You're saying the fact that we're worried speaks volumes about the nation itself.
Marat shrugged.
As we will force nothing on USA persons in their warm homes. We will make only available entertainment. There will be then some choosing to partake or choose not to.
Smoothing slightly at his lap's blanket.
How will USAs choose? Who has taught them to choose with care? How will your offices and agencies protect them, your people? By laws? By killing Quebecois?
Marat rose, but very slightly.
As you were killing Colombians and Bolivians to protect USA citizens who desire their narcotics? How well did this work for your agencies and offices, the killing? How long was it before the Brazilians replaced the dead of Colombia?
Steeply's wig had slipped hard to starboard. Raimi, no. Drug dealers don't want you dead necessarily. They just want your money. There's a difference. You people seem to want us dead, not just the concavity re-demised, not just secession for Quebec. The FLQ, maybe they're like the Bolivians, but Fortier wants us dead.
Again, you pass over what is important. Why BSS cannot understand us? You cannot kill what is already dead.
Just you wait and see if we're dead, Paisano. Marat made a gesture as if striking his own head.
Again, passing over the importance. This appetite to choose death by pleasure, if it is available to choose. This appetite of your people unable to choose appetites. This is the death. What you call the death, the collapsing, this will be the formality only. Do you not see? This was the genius of Guillaume de Plussy. What Monsieur de Plussy taught the cells, even if FLQ and Le Fil did not understand. Much less the Albertans, all crazy inside their head. We of the AFR, we understand. This is why the sale of Quebecers, that danger of entertainment so fine it will kill the viewer. If so, the exact way does not matter. The exact time of death, then way of death, this no longer matters. Not for your peoples, you wish to protect them. But you can only delay, not save. The entertainment exists. The attaché and the gendarme of the Razzle incident? More proof. It is there, existing. The choice for death of the head by pleasure now exists, and your authorities know. Or you would not be now trying to stop the pleasure. Your Saint Christi gentle was in this one part correct. Someone is to blame.
That had nothing to do with the reconfiguration. The reconfiguration was self-preservation.
That, forget it. There is the villain he saw you needed, all of you, to delay this splitting apart, to keep you together, the hating some other.
Gentle is crazy in his head, but in this, fault at someone, he was correct in saying it. Un ennemi commun.
But not someone outside you, this enemy. Someone or some people among your own history sometime killed your USA nation already, Hugh. Someone who had authority, or should have had authority, and did not exercise authority. I do not know. But someone sometime let you forget how to choose and what. Someone let your peoples forget it was the only thing of importance, choosing. So completely forgetting that when I say choose to you, you make expressions with your face such as, here we are going. Someone taught that temples are for fanatics only, and took away the temples and promised there was no need for temples. And now, there is no shelter, and no map for finding the shelter of a temple. And you all stumble about in the dark, this confusion of permissions. The without-end pursuit of a happiness of which someone let you forget the old things which made happiness possible. How is it you say? Anything is going?
And this is why we shudder at what a separate Quebec would be like. Choose what we tell you. Neglect your own wish and desires. Sacrifice. For Quebec. For the state.
Marat shrugged. L'état protecteur.
Steeply said, does this sound a little familiar, Raimi? The National Socialist, neo-fascist state of separate Quebec? You guys are worse than the worst Albertans. Totalitarity. Cuba with snow. Ski immediately to your nearest re-education camp for instructions on choosing. Moral eugenics. China, Cambodia, Chad, unfree.
Unhappy.
There are no choices without personal freedom, Buckaroo. It's not us who are dead inside. These things you find so weak and contemptible in us, these are just the hazards of being free.
But what does this USA expression want to mean, this Buckaroo?
Steeply turned to face away into the space they were above. And now here we go. Now you will say, how free are we if you dangle fatal fruit before us and we cannot help ourselves from temptation, and we say human to you. We say that one cannot be human without freedom.
Marat's chair squeaked slightly as his weight shifted.
Always with you this freedom. for your walled-up country always to shout, "Freedom! Freedom!" as if it were obvious to all people what it wants to mean, this word. But look, it is not so simple as that. Your freedom is the freedom from. No one tells your precious individual USA selves what they must do. It is this meaning only, this freedom from constraint and forced duress. Murat, over Steeply's shoulder, suddenly can realize why the skies above the coruscating city were themselves erased of stars. It was the fumes from the exhausts, wastes of the moving autos' pretty lights that rose and hid stars from the city and made the city Tucson's loom nacreous in the dome's blackness of it. But what of the freedom too? Not just free from. Not all compulsion comes from without. You pretend you do not see this. What of freedom too? How for the person to freely choose? How to choose any but a child's greedy choices if there is no loving field father to guide, inform, teach the person how to choose? How is there freedom to choose if one does not learn how to choose? Steeply threw away his cigarette and faced partly Murat from the edge.
Now the story of the rich man.
Murat said, the rich father who can afford the cost of candy as well as food for his children. But if he cries out, freedom, and allows his child to choose only what is sweet, eating only candy, not pea soup and bread and eggs, so his child becomes weak and sick. Is the rich man who cries freedom the good father? Steeply made four small noises. Excitement of some belief made the American's electrolysis's little pimples of rash redden even in the milky dilute light of loom and low stars. The moon over the mountains of Rincon was on its side, its color the color of a fat man's face. Murat could believe he could hear some young USA voices shouting and laughing in a young gathering somewhere out on the desert floor below, but saw no headlights or young persons. Steeply stamped a high heel in frustration. Steeply said,
but U.S. citizens aren't presumed by us to be children, to paternalistically do their thinking and choosing for them. Human beings are not children.
Murat pretended again to sniff. Ah, yes, but then you say, no?
Steeply said, no. You say, not children? You say, what is the difference, please, if you make a recorded pleasure so entertaining and diverting it is lethal to persons? You find a copy-capable copy and copy it and disseminate it for us to choose to see or turn off, and if we cannot choose to resist it, the pleasure, and cannot choose instead to live? You say what your Fortier believes, that we are children, not human adults like the noble Quebecers. We are children. Bullies, but still children inside, and we kill ourselves for you if you put the candy within the arm's reach.
Murat tried to make his face expressive of anger, which was difficult for him. This is what happens. You imagine the things I will say, and then say them for me, and then become angry with them. Without my mouth, it never opens. You speak to yourself, inventing sides. This itself is the habit of children. Lazy, lonely self. I am not even here, possibly, for listening to. Unmentioned by either man was how in heaven's name either man expected to get up or down from the mountain-sized shelf in the dark of the U.S. desert's night. The 8th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment, Interdependence Day. Every year at ETA, maybe a dozen of the kids between maybe like 12 and 15, children in the very earliest stages of puberty, and really abstract, capable thought, when one's allergy to the confined realities of the present is just starting to emerge as weird kind of nostalgia for stuff you never even knew.
120.
Maybe a dozen of these kids, mostly male, get fanatically devoted to a homemade academy game called Eschaton. Eschaton is the most complicated children's game anybody around ETA'd ever heard of. No one's entirely sure who brought it to Enfield, from where.
but you can pretty easily date its conception from the mechanics of the game itself. Its basic structure had already pretty much coalesced when Alston's Michael Pemulis hit age 12 and helped make it way more compelling. Its elegant complexity, combined with a dismissive reenactment frisson and a complete disassociation from the realities of the present, composes most of its puerile appeal. Plus, it's almost addictively compelling and shocks the tall. This year, it's been Otis P. Lord, a 13-year-old bassliner and calculus phenom from Wilmington, Delaware, who wears the beanie as Eschaton's game master and statistician of record, though Pemulis, since he's still around and is far and away the greatest Eschaton player in ETA history, has a kind of unofficial emeritus power of correction over Lord's calculations and mandate. Eschaton takes 8 to 12 people to play with 400 tennis balls so dead and bald they can't even be used for service drills anymore, plus an open expanse equal to the area of 4 contiguous tennis courts, plus a head for data retrieval and coldly logical cognition, along with at least 40 megabytes of available RAM and wide array of tennis paraphernalia. The Vadi Mikamish rulebook that Pemulis in YPW got Hal Incandenza to write, with appendices and sample
C:\PinkSub2/MathPack/NSTAT path decision tree diagrams, and an offset of the most accessible essay Pemulis could find on applied game theory,
is about as long and interesting as J. Bunyan's stupefying Pilgrim's Progress from this world to that which is to come, and a pretty tough nut to compress into anything lively, although every year a dozen more ETA kids memorize the thing at such a fanatical depth that they sometimes report reciting mumbled passages under light dental or cosmetic anesthesia years later. But if Hal had a Luger pointed at him and were under compulsion to try, he'd probably start by explaining that each of the 400 dead tennis balls in the game's global arsenal represents a 5-megaton thermonuclear warhead. Of the total number of a given day's players,
121.
3 compose a theoretical Anschluss designated Amnat. Another 3, Sovwar. 1 or 2, Red Chai. Another 1 or 2, the wacko but always pesky, Libseer, or more formidable, Ear Libseer. And that the day's remaining players, depending on involved random considerations, can form anything from South Af to Ind Pak, to like an independent cell of Nook insurgents with a 50-click howitzer and big ideas. Each team is called a combatant. On the open expanse of contiguous courts, combatants are arrayed in positions corresponding to their location on the planet Earth as represented in the Rand McNally slightly rectangular hanging map of the world.
122.
Practical distribution of total megatonnage requires a working knowledge of the mean value theorem of integrals.
123.
But for Hal's synoptic purposes here, it's enough to say that megatonnage is distributed among combatants according to an integrally regressed ratio of A, combatants' yearly military budget as percentage of combatants' yearly GNP, to B, the inverse of stratego-tactical expenditures as percentage of combatants' yearly military budget. In quainter days, combatants' balls were simply doled out by throws of shiny red Yahtzee dice. Quaint chance is no longer required because Pemulis has downloaded MathPack Unlimited's elegant NSTAT Stats Cruncher software into the late James Incandenza's fearsome, idle, drop-clothed DEC 2100.
124.
And has shown Otis P. Lord
how to dicky the lock to Stitt's office at night with a dining hall meal card and plug the DCE into a 3-prong
that's under the lower left corner of the enormous print of Dewar's The Magnificent Beast on the wall by the relevant edge of Stitt's big glass desk. So Stitt or DeLint won't even know it's on, when it's on, then link it by cellular modem to a slick, you-shit-you portable with collar monitor out on the court's nuclear theater. AMNAT and SOVWAR usually end up with about 400 total megatons each, with the rest inconsistently divided. It's possible to complicate Pemulus's mean value equation for distribution by factoring in stuff like historical incidences of bellicosity and appeasement, unique characteristics of perceived national interests, etc. But Lord, the son of not one, but two bankers is a straight bang-for-buck type of apportioner, a stance the equally bottom-line-minded Michael Pemulus endorses with both thumbs. Pieces of tennis gear are carefully placed within each combatant's territories to mirror and map strategic targets. Folded gray-on-red ETA t-shirts are MAMAs, or Major Metro Areas. Towels are stolen from selected motels on the junior tour stand for airfields, bridges, satellite-linked monitoring facilities, carrier groups, conventional power plants, important rail convergences. Red tennis shorts with gray trim are CON4CONs, meaning conventional force concentrations. The black cotton ETA armbands, for when God forbid there's a death, designate the non-contemporary game era's atomic power plants, uranium or plutonium enrichment facilities, gaseous diffusion plants, breeder reactors, initiator factories, neutron scattering reflector labs, tritium production reactor vessels, heavy water plants, semi-private shaped charge concerns, linear accelerators, and the especially point-heavy annular fusion research laboratories in North Syracuse, New York, and Presque Isle, Maine, Chongskrig, Kyrgyzstan, and Pliscu, Romania, and possibly elsewhere. Red shorts with gray trim, few in number because strongly disliked by the traveling squads, are SSTRACs, equally low number but point-intensive sites of strategic command. SOCs are either missile installations or anti-missile installations or isolated silo clusters or cruise-capable B-2 or SS-5 squadrons. Let's draw the curtain of charity across any more millibrebs. Depending on whether they're boys' tennis socks or boys' street shoe socks or girls' tennis socks with the little bunny tail at the heel or girls' tennis socks without the bunny tail. Toe-worn cast-off corporate-supplied sneakers sit open-mouthed and serenely lethal, strongly suggesting the subs they stand for. In the game, combatants' 5-megaton warheads can be launched only with handheld tennis rackets. Hence, the requirement of actual physical targeting skill that separates Eschaton from Rotisserie League Holocaust games played with protractors and PCs around kitchen tables. The paraboloid transcontinental flight of a liquid-fuel strategic delivery vehicle closely resembles a top-spin lob. One reason the ETA administration and staff unofficially permit Eschaton to absorb students' attention and commitment might be that the game's devotees tend to develop terrific lobs. Pemulus's lobs can nail a coin on the baseline 2 out of 3 times off either side, is why it's idiotic that he rushes the net so much instead of letting the other guy come in more. Warheads can be launched independently or packed into an intricately knotted athletic supporter designed to open out in mid-flight and release multiple independent reentry vehicles known as MIRVs. MIRVs, being a profligate use of a combatant's available megatonnage, tend to get used only if a game of Eschaton metastasizes from a controlled set of spasm exchanges, known as SPASX, to an all-out apocalyptic series of punishing strikes against civilian populations, known as SACPOP. Few combatants will go to SACPOP unless compelled by the remorseless logic of game theory, since SACPOP exchanges usually end up costing both combatants so many points, they're eliminated from further contention. A given Eschaton's winning team is simply that combatant with the most favorable ratio of points for Endear, or infliction of death, destruction, and incapacitation of response. 2. Sufdidir, self-evident. Though the assignment of point values for each combatant's shirts, towels, shorts, armbands, socks, and shoes is statistically icky. Plus, there are also wildly involved corrections for initial megatonnage, population density, land, sea, air delivery distributions, and EM pulse-resistant civil defense expenditures, so that the official victor takes 3 hours of NSTAT number crunching and at least 4 Motrin for Otis P. Lord to confirm. Another reason why each year's master statistician has to be a special combination of tech wonk and compulsive is that the Baroque apparatus of each eschaton has to be worked out in advance and then sold to a kind of immature and easily bored community of world leaders.
A quorum of the day's combatants has to endorse a particular simulated world situation, as Lords stayed up well past several bedtimes to develop it.
Land, sea, air force distributions, ethnic, sociologic, economic, and even religious demographics for each combatant, plus broadly sketched psych profiles of all relevant heads of state, prevailing weather in all the maps, quadrants, etc. Then everybody playing that day is assigned to a combatant's team, and they all sit down over purified water and unfatted chips to hash out between combatants stuff like mutual defense alliances, humane war pacts, facilities for intercombatant communication, DEFCON gradients, city trading, and so on. Since each combatant's team knows only their own situation profile and total available megatonnage, and since even out in the forecourt theater the stockpiled warheads are hidden from view inside the identical white plastic cast-off industrial solvent buckets all academies and serious players use for drill balls,
125.
There can be a lot of poker facing about response resolve, willingness to go sack pop, non-negotiable interests, EM pulse immunity, distribution of strategic forces, and commitment to geopolitical ideals. You should have seen Michael Pemulis just about eat the whole world alive during pre-eschaton summits back when he played. His teams won most games before the first lob landed. What often takes the longest to get a quorum on is each game's triggering situation. Here, Lord, like many stellar statistics wonks, shows a bit of an Achilles heel imagination-wise. But he's got a good 5 or 6 years of eschaton precedence to draw on. A Russo-Chinese border dispute goes tactical over Xinjiang. An Amnot computer tracker in the Aleutians misreads a flight of geese as 3 Sovwar SS-10s on re-entry. Israel moves armored divisions north and east through Jordan after an El Al Airbus is bombed in mid-flight by a cell linked to both Husseins. Black Albertan wackos infiltrate an isolated silo at Fort Chimo and get 2 MIRVs through South AF's defense net. North Korea invades South Korea, vice versa. AMNAT is within 72 hours of putting an impregnable string of anti-missile satellites online, and the remorseless logic of game theory compels Sovwar to go sackpop while it still has the chance. On Interdependence Day, Sunday, 11-8, Game Master Lord's triggering situation unwinds nicely on Pemulis's view. Explosions of suspicious origin occur at AMNAT satellite receiver stations from Turkey to Labrador as 3 high-level Canadian defense ministers vanish, and then a couple of days later are photographed at a Volgograd bistro, hoisting shots of Stolichnaya with Slavic bimbos on their knee.
126.
Then 2 Sovwar trawlers, just inside international waters off Washington, are strafed by F-16s on patrol out of Cape Flattery Naval Base. Both AMNAT and Sovwar go from DEFCON 2 to DEFCON 4. Red Chai goes to DEFCON 3 in response to which Sovwar airfields and anti-missile networks from Irkutsk to the Jugjur Range go to DEFCON 5, in response to which AMNAT sack bombers and anti-missile missile silos in Nebraska and South Dakota and Saskatchewan and eastern Spain assume a maximum readiness posture. Sovwar's bald and port wine-stained premier calls Amnat's waddle-chinned president on the hotline and asks him if he's got Prince Albert in a can.
127.
Another pretty shady explosion levels a Sovwar Big Ear monitoring station on Sakhalin. General Atomic Inc.'s gaseous diffusion uranium enrichment facility in Portsmouth, Ohio, reports 4 kilograms of enriched uranium hexafluoride missing, and then suffers a cataclysmic fire that forces evacuation of 6 downwind counties. An Amnat minesweeper of the 6th Fleet on maneuvers in the Red Sea is hit and sunk with Red Chai silkworm torpedoes fired by Libsir MiG-25s. Italy, in an apparently bizarre NSTAT-generated development, Otis P. Lord will only smile enigmatically about, invades Albania. Sovwar goes apeshit. Apoplectic premier rings Amnat's president, only to be asked if his refrigerator's running. Libsir shocks the Christian world by airbursting a half-megaton device 2 clicks over Tel Aviv, causing deaths in the low 6 figures. Everybody and his brother goes to DEFCON 5. Air Force One leaves the ground. South Af and Red Chai announce neutrality and plead for cool heads. Israeli armored columns behind heavy tactical artillery saturation push into Syria all the way to Abu Kanal in 12 hours. Damascus has firestorms. And Nebk is reportedly just plain gone. Several repressive right-wing regimes in the Third World suffer coup d'etat and are replaced by repressive left-wing regimes. Tehran and Baghdad announce full diplomatic and military support of Libsir, thus reconstituting Libsir as Ir Libsir. Amnat and Sovwar activate all civil defense personnel and armed forces reserves and commence evacuation of selected MAs. Ir Libsir is today represented by Evan Ingersoll, whom Axford keeps growling at under his breath, Hal can hear. A shifty-eyed member of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff vanishes and isn't photographed anywhere. Albania sues for terms. Crude and apparently amateur devices in the low kiloton range explode across Israel from Haifa to Ashkelon. Tripoli is incommunicado after at least 4 thermonuclear explosions cause second-degree burns as far away as Medinin, Tunisia. A 10-kiloton tactical artillery device airbursts over the command center of the Czech Third Army in Ostrava, resulting in what one Pentagon analyst calls a serious weenie roast. Despite the fact that nobody but Sovwar itself has anybody close enough to hit Ostrava from howitzer distance, Sovwar stonewalls Amnat's denials and regrets. Amnat's president tries ringing Sovwar's premier from the air and gets only the premier's answering machine. Amnat is unable to determine whether the string of explosions at its radar installations all along the Arctic Circle are conventional or tactical. CIA-NSA reports that 64% of the civilian populations of Sovwar's MAMAs have been successfully relocated below ground in hardened shelters. Amnat orders evacuation of all MAMAs. Sovwar MiG-25s engage Red Chai aircraft overseas off Tianjin. Air Force 2 tries to leave the ground and gets a flat tire. A single 1-megaton SS-10 evades anti-missile missiles and detonates just over Provo, Utah, from which all communications abruptly cease. Eschaton's Game Master now posits, but does not go so far as to actually assert, that NSTAT's game theoretic decision tree now dictates a SPASX response from Amnat. Uninitiated adults who might be parked in a nearby mint-green advertorial Ford sedan, or might stroll casually past ETA's 4 easternmost tennis courts and see an atavistic global nuclear conflict game played by tanned and energetic little kids, and so this might naturally expect to see fuzzless green warheads getting whacked indiscriminately skyward all over the place as everybody gets blackly drunk with thanatoptic fury in the crisp November air, these adults would more likely find an actual game of Eschaton strangely subdued, almost narcotized-looking. Your standard round of Eschaton moves at about the pace of chess between adepts. For these devotees become, on court, almost, parodically, adult. Staid, sober, humane, and judicious 12-year-old world leaders trying their best not to let the awesome weight of their responsibilities, responsibilities to nation, globe, rationality, ideology, conscience, and history, to both the living and the unborn,